You're listening to episode 2 of The Gearheart. I'm your reader, writer, and host, Alex White. Renee White is the voice of our female characters. If you haven't had a chance yet, or you're listening on iTunes or podiobooks.com, you can stop by the Gearheart blog and interact at www.thegearheart.com, or you can email me directly at alex@thegearheart.com. Don't forget that you can also follow us on Twitter, username TheGearheart. And now, settle in, pour a cup of tea, and enjoy as we bring you more tales of the Gearheart. Last time on the Gearheart, Jonathan and the others break into a mob-controlled warehouse to steal a magical artifact and quickly find that things don't work out like they planned. As they race up the old country highway, Jonathan's bullet wound seethes. Just how serious is it? And are they out of the woods just yet? Find out on the Gearheart. Their hands were cold. The metal table was cold. Even Jonathan's fear felt cold. After Jonathan made his way into the deserted mill alongside Keegan, Isabel, and Cog, the two girls laid him down on a counting table and stripped off his shirt. Jonathan shivered uncontrollably, even though he was trying to remain collected. He didn't want the ladies to see him shirtless and frightened. Isabel's expression was overflowing with sympathy, but Cog simply got to work. Jonathan was honestly surprised. He hadn't expected that there would be a piece of secret property in St. David, much less a full-sized mill. While it was true that the building was falling apart inside and out, and the equipment had been cleared away, the property was sizable and accessible within 30 minutes after they pulled the warehouse job. Keegan stayed on the radio and sent Augustus on to the airport to secure his biplane, the Avenger, and instructed the pilot to meet the team at the safe house in Edenton. Augustus, not very accustomed to the sight of blood, happily obliged. Keegan had then telephoned Agent Darren Freeman, who was taking care of another deal in a restaurant in town. Jonathan was happy that Darren was on his way. The whole business of being shot frightened the initiate terribly.
"You're not losing very much blood, so that's good," said Cog.
Jonathan looked at the slithering vermilion trail that led from the room all the way back to the truck and said, "Thanks." His first realization of lightheadedness came shortly after he spoke, and he wasn't sure why he had thanked Cog. At the edge of the room, Keegan lit up a cigarette and watched through a crack in the door to see if they were followed. The flame of his match lit the man's thin, dignified face, and he sucked in a lungful of smoke with a look of near disdain. The headmaster checked his watch and frowned. Cog leaned over Jonathan's face as he lay back on the table, and she tried to smile. It didn't suit her.
"Jonathan, I'd like to know how deep this wound goes."
Isabel clasped Jonathan's clean hand. His other hand was covered in blood from the wound on his shoulder. Her concerned warmth seemed to flow through her fingertips, and Jonathan thought of the time before the Seekers had come into their lives. There had been plenty of times when Jonathan and Isabel had comforted each other as children after sustaining an injury while exploring the forest near her house. "Does that mean—" Jonathan began.
"I'll be quick,"
said Cog, cutting him off. There was a sickening, sludgy sound of congealed blood as Cog lifted a flap of skin over the wound. It burned like fire, but Jonathan gritted his teeth and bore the pain well. In fact, he wasn't sure why they had insisted that he lie down.
"Oh, this is nothing,"
said Cog with a sigh of relief. "Oh, yeah?" said Jonathan, yelping as she let the wound go back to its original position. It was true that the wound didn't hurt nearly as much as the time that Jonathan was stabbed during his duties 2 years prior, but it wasn't nothing.
"Just surface damage,"
said Cog, and Isabel let out a long breath.
"See, Jonathan, nothing to worry about,"
said Isabel. Jonathan did not point out that Isabel looked far more worried than he did. Isabel took off her fur-lined jacket, revealing the long-sleeve button-up work shirt underneath. Her clothing seemed almost military issue, but not quite. The garment was obviously sewn for a small, factory-working male, but the attire was sort of cute on her petite figure. She certainly couldn't be breaking and entering in a dress. Jonathan watched impressed as Isabel drew a much smaller orange glyph that hung in the air like a light bulb from a cord. The sigil pulsed and sent waves of warmth over the room, and before long, the team removed their coats and scarves. Jonathan stopped shivering almost immediately. The initiate found himself continually amazed by her mastery of fire magic and the different ways that she could apply it.
"Have we been followed?"
asked Cog. "Not likely," said Keegan. "If we had, they would have attacked when they saw the blood on Jonathan's arm." "So what did we steal?" asked Jonathan in an uneven voice, grunting as Cog bound his arm in bits of torn shirt. "An artifact with arcane potential," replied Keegan. "Potential to do what exactly?" said Jonathan. Keegan took another drag of his cigarette as he meandered toward the center of the open room. He stopped close to Jonathan and scratched his eyebrow with the thumb of his cigarette hand. The headmaster's gold ring, which signified his membership in the Seekers, glittered with the incandescence of Isabel's glyph. "Arcane things, Initiate Andrews. I'm sorry, but I'm not supposed to discuss the particulars of this with you." "I was just curious," said Jonathan. "Sorry, didn't mean to come off as rude," said Keegan. "I was ordered not to tell you anything about the target's magical value." "They still don't trust me at the main house, do they?" asked Jonathan. Keegan sighed. "It's not that, Jonathan. It's just that it takes a lot of commitment to be an agent." "Keegan, Dr. Wilkinson, I've been in the Seekers for 2 years. I got stabbed in the gut because of them," said Jonathan. "Couldn't you just tell me what's in the crate I got shot taking?" Isabel smiled at Jonathan.
"You shouldn't worry so much. It took me 5 years to become agent."
Jonathan glanced over at Isabel. He didn't want to sound like he was criticizing her for siding with Keegan, but he wanted to tell her that it took her 5 years because she joined the Seekers when she was 13. Isabel made agent on her 18th birthday, which was as young as the Seekers ever allowed. "Yeah, maybe you're right," he said. "I shouldn't get so wound up." "You must know, mustn't you?" said Keegan, looking Jonathan in the eyes. "No, Headmaster, you were right to follow your orders. I'm fine now." Keegan smirked as he took another drag. "You know, I was just like that when I joined. It's tough when you're older. When you're just a kid, all that stuff makes more sense. You don't get to know because the grown-ups told you that you don't get to know." Cog walked over to a window and glanced out through the foggy panes.
"It's not like when you're older and you feel patronized because your peers are privy to information that you are not. Am I right, Keegan?"
Keegan laughed, ignoring the sharpness in her tone. "If only I were Jonathan's peer, Cog. I would love to be in my 20s again." "Don't worry," said Jonathan. "I wouldn't trade you years just to know what's in that crate." "Well, you won't have to, Initiate," said Keegan. "I'll tell you. I'll tell you in light of the fact that you took a bullet for it. And when we get back, I'll write a letter recommending you for agent." Jonathan's eyes lit up. Keegan hadn't recommended anyone for a promotion since one of the other agents died in the line of duty. "Really? I'm not just gonna hand off another unmarked crate to the quartermaster?" "It's a kind of spirit," said the headmaster. "A stone sprite, to be more precise." "I'm sorry?" asked the initiate. Keegan went on to explain that the spirit was trapped in a bronze idol, and that the mobsters had no idea what it actually was. Jonathan was relieved. He didn't want to live in a world where the mob had figured out how to use magic. Keegan continued, saying that the idol was both lucky and valuable, but the relative power of the device was totally unknown. "If we knew it was fairly weak, would we still have stolen it?" asked Jonathan. "Definitely. We can't have known artifacts in the hands of anyone else, especially not large organized groups," said Keegan. Isabel stepped forward.
"I think the odds that a government or anybody else could successfully analyze the thing are pretty low, but any odds at all are too high."
Cog smirked.
"I've always wondered what the Seekers would do if I told them I didn't want to see them again. What do you think, Dr. Wilkinson? Would you try to capture me and maintain your monopoly?"
Keegan leaned back and looked out the window. "Darren is here," he said. Darren's emerald glyph throbbed in the air as the black-bearded agent touched Jonathan's arm. Jonathan watched in awe as the cut on his arm sealed slightly and a tear opened in Darren's skin in the same place. Cog was ready, and she caught the spurt of blood and a bit of gauze that Darren had brought for just that purpose. Jonathan felt the warmth radiate through him, even as Darren winced. "Why is it," Darren began, "that I am always patching you up, Initiate?" "Because you can't find anyone else to do it for you?" said Jonathan. Darren wiped his hands off on another piece of gauze as Cog dressed his wound and bound it. If anyone else could do my job, Jonathan, I would pay them myself. All that was left was to clean up. The crimson-stained excess gauze was gathered and burned in a wooden stove, along with the clothes from the job. Everyone changed into their plain clothes. Jonathan and Isabel took scrubbing brushes and a bucket of soapy water and cleaned the blood out of the boards and continued onto the pavement next to the Deuce and a Half. Meanwhile, Cog, Keegan, and Darren set about getting the truck under a tarp. Augustus would lead a retrieval team to dismantle the vehicle later. As Jonathan and the others packed their gear into the two cars that lay waiting outside, the initiate just barely heard Darren tell Keegan that he had been lent to the Redfield chapter for an expedition. Darren said that he simply wanted to confirm that Keegan didn't have any problems with the temporary exchange. "Go on," Keegan had responded. "We're not busy now, anyway. Isabella's heading out to Cerceville in a week and a half, so I don't expect anything big from dispatch." "So, why you headed out to Cerceville?" Jonathan asked from behind his glass of whiskey. The warm candlelight of the restaurant shivered in the gentle amber of the whiskey glass. Isabel was dressed in her evening finery, a low-cut black satin dress and a hairpiece of flowing golden ligatures. Little pearls studded the wires and gave her hair the illusion of stars floating against the silken brown. She would have been stunning if Jonathan had bothered to notice. It had been a week since they had returned from St. David with the idol. As with every previous package, Jonathan didn't actually get to see the object before it was placed in a covert shipment to Quartermaster Levinson back at the main house. Keegan said that, because of the unique nature of Jonathan's powers, he was afraid to let the initiate interact with the idol. Jonathan couldn't blame him, but the initiate didn't understand why a peek would have hurt. The ordeal with the idol wasn't what really got under Jonathan's skin, though. What was painful was that, after all that Keegan had said, the headmaster retracted his promises when they arrived back at their hometown of Edenton. Keegan had tried to explain, tried to tell Jonathan that he had merely spoken too soon, too much in the heat of the moment. Keegan tried to tell Jonathan that he had promoted by mistake, and that the last time that he did that, the new, young agent had died tragically. Jonathan figured that it was all a very diplomatic way to say that Keegan had lost his nerve.
"Hmm?"
said Isabel. "Ah, come on, Izzy, don't be coy," said Jonathan. "I overheard Keegan telling Darren that you were headed out to Cerceville."
"Why are you being so cross?"
Isabel asked. The glitter was gone from her eye.
"I'm sure Keegan was going to tell you sooner or later."
"Actually, I don't think he was." Isabel crossed her arms.
"Did you drag me here to mope?"
"Yeah, actually," said Jonathan. "I'm not going to be an agent anytime soon."
"Don't be ridiculous,"
she laughed.
"That's why you're upset?"
Jonathan sucked air in through his teeth, aerating the whiskey and creating an explosion of new flavors from hot cinnamon to paint thinner. He gulped the fluid and coughed. "Why wouldn't I be upset? I've been a part of this whole thing for a while, and now it looks like our headmaster is never going to move on." Isabel affected a sympathetic schoolteacher smile and leaned forward over the table. Her earrings sparkled, throwing lights across her slender neck. Jonathan wasn't paying any attention.
"You knew, Blaze. You know how that had to affect Keegan."
"Hmm," said Jonathan, his nose buried in his whiskey glass.
"I don't even know why I came here with you,"
said Isabel, throwing her napkin at him. It settled over his face, veiling the initiate and his glass under it. Jonathan pulled the napkin off of his head and cracked a smile, his first of the night. "I'm sorry, Isabel. I just wanted to commiserate. I thought I was finally in the club." Isabel sighed.
"You are in the club, Jonathan. And being in the club means making sacrifices like not getting a promotion just because you want one."
Jonathan leaned back in his seat and set his whiskey on the table. He was still wearing his clumsy smirk. "You make my motives sound so base."
"Well, they are. You want to be an agent just to be an agent."
"No, I..."
"You what? You want to have to file three times as many reports as you do now?"
"No."
"You want to be in front of machine gun fire?"
she asked.
"Because that's where I was last week."
"Hey," he interrupted. "I'm the one who got shot here. You can't tell me that it's that much safer to be an initiate." Isabel propped her hand up under her chin.
"I suppose."
Her eyes connected with his for what seemed like the first time since they had arrived. He was looking at her sidelong as he lifted the whiskey to his soft lips. She arched her eyebrows.
"So why do you want to become an agent so badly?"
We were peers once, Isabel, Jonathan said. There was never any rank between us as kids. You never led on when you joined the Seekers.
I wanted to tell you so badly, Jonathan, but I didn't think you had any magic. I never dreamed we were going to recruit you one day,
said Isabel, sitting up. Well, can you imagine how that feels, though? To find out that your best friend is some kind of magic spy?
Can you imagine?
Isabel started, but then quieted down as a waiter passed too close to their table.
What it's like to have the biggest secret in the world and not be able to share it with the people you care about the most? I almost told you so many times.
But now you don't have to do that anymore, right? Asked Jonathan. No more secrets?
Right.
Jonathan's grin pulled wide and his eyes narrowed. Then why are you going to Cerceval? She began, but she merely opened and closed her mouth like a fish. Her gaze drifted down to the linen tablecloth.
Jonathan, you...
I'm just proving a point. You can't tell me, can you? Isabel propped her skinny elbows on the table.
You know what? Fine. You win. I'm going to Cerceval to meet with the Imperial Gelset Army Special Liaison in order to discuss some important information that he claims to have. He hasn't said what it is yet, but he will only discuss it with me. We're meeting at a gala, and from there we are going on a luxury steamer for 4 days, undercover as newlyweds.
Jonathan was stunned by the sudden candor. Her teeth shone between her brilliant lips as she almost sneered at the initiate.
And I got his dossier the other day. It had a photo in it. He's a strapping young man.
It was now Jonathan's turn to gape. Eventually, he managed to utter the words, "He'll only talk to you." Doesn't that sound like a trap?
Oh, it'll be fine. Cerceval is sending a couple of queensmen,
she said.
So, now you know everything. Are you jealous?
Why would I want to go on a cruise with another man?
Not of that.
Jonathan laughed. I'm kidding, Izzy. I'm not jealous at all. I mean, I don't want some strange man pawing all over you, but this is your job. I wouldn't be that petty. Isabel chewed on Jonathan's statement for a moment.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, and who knows? Maybe you'll hit it off with this gentleman. Isabel's face soured a little.
Yeah, maybe so.
Milky light slipped into the vaulted windows of Uncle Milton's studies as Jonathan pored over a tome of folksy old Caldalvi peasant verse. It was a copy of a collected anthology from over 200 years ago, and one of the few publications to come out of a country in so much turmoil. Milton had impressed upon the young man the importance of poetry in understanding the society of the Caldalvi, and forced the book into Jonathan's hands. The initiate was trying to be as interested as Milton, but it wasn't working for him, even though the old man's enthusiasm was somewhat infectious. The book was absolutely impenetrable to a layperson like Jonathan, and the young man found his training in anthropology to be of little use. On top of that, his status as a seeker led him to try to read everything as though there were some hidden magical message in it, and Jonathan was continually frustrated to find that some old books were simply that, old books. Divided in half, then I am the chaff, the mewling cat and the suckling calf. What of the snow and what of the stream? What of the air and what does it mean? My thoughts exactly, said Jonathan and slapped the book shut. He wasn't looking forward to the inevitable lecture that Milton would give him about what an idiot he was for failing to both understand and appreciate Caldalvi poetry. The poem rhymed when translated, so Jonathan could always fall back on the defense that he didn't appreciate the translator taking liberties with the work. He looked around and pulled out his pocket watch. It was late afternoon, and the old man should have been finished teaching classes any minute. Cog had left to purchase groceries for the two bachelors, so the initiate knew that she would not return home for some time. Jonathan predicted that when Milton came back, they would have to have a talk that would invariably end in Milton indicting Jonathan for joining the Seekers and abandoning his education. Even though Jonathan was certainly old enough to live on his own, his old guardian still believed that higher education was the key to happiness and forced him to learn everything that Milton's students had to learn. The old man didn't want rent. He wanted scholarship, which was so much worse. Jonathan heard the keys jingle in the heavy wooden door at the front of the townhouse and quite spontaneously decided to put the kettle on the stove. The last thing that Jonathan wanted was for Uncle Milton to find him in the study and ask what he thought of the book. Maybe if he was lucky, Milton would catch him in the kitchen and be so tired that the old man would forget about his book in favor of a nice, hot cup of tea. As Jonathan approached the foyer, however, he heard the distinctly heavy yet delicate footsteps of Cog. She entered, chased by a breeze, in her herringbone twill long coat, knit scarf, and beret. Jonathan wondered if she got as cold as he did when it was this frosty outside. If not, she certainly knew how to dress like she was cold. In one arm, she carried a paper sack of produce from the farmer's market, leafy greens bursting over the top. Underneath her other arm was a large package, wrapped in brown leather and shipping twine, marked Antonello. A knot tightened in Jonathan's stomach. Sometimes he forgot that Antonello was her real surname. He had come to hate the Antonellos so much after they nearly killed him 2 years prior, it was always a shock to be reminded that she was a part of that bloodline, even if she was separated from them by almost 800 years. Compared to her descendants, she just seemed too nice. Cog glanced up, her chrysanthemum pink irises surveying the room, and Jonathan ducked out of the way. Somehow it seemed like he should feel guilty for intruding, though he knew not why. Jonathan was certain that Cog's keen senses would discover him. He even worried that she might attack him by mistake, and he was prepared to offer up his presence should she take even one step down the hallway. That step didn't come. Instead, she hurried up the stairs, down the hallway, and closed the door to her room. Jonathan went to follow her, but stopped at the edge of the upstairs corridor. Surely she'd heard his approach from the hallway. What could she possibly be doing that would have her avoiding him so? He could ask her, and he knew that she would tell him. According to her, she was his honor-bound servant for saving her life. Jonathan could not bring himself to take advantage of that fact, so it did not matter. He shouldn't be following her or spying on her. Cog had enough secrets, and he knew that she would reveal anything relevant in time. Then he heard the eager tearing of the shipping paper, and was compelled to linger just a while longer at the end of the hallway. There was a plucked string, a perfectly shaped tone, balanced on the edge of the air, ringing from behind her bedroom door like a bell. The attack and decay of the note had a sort of balanced tension, like a clear drop of dew hanging from a leaf. Then another note followed, so discordant as to murder the harmony in cold blood. The notes began to yowl up and down, and Jonathan found himself incredibly disappointed, thinking that he shouldn't be risking a violation of Cog's trust for something so trivial. Suddenly, silence.
"Jonathan,"
came Cog's voice. Jonathan winced. "Yes?"
"You'll be able to hear better in here. Come inside."
Jonathan complied and opened the door to Cog's austere room. She had done nothing with the place since moving in at Uncle Milton's request, but Jonathan supposed he understood. She was a warrior, not a woman, and this culture was not her own. Cog had actually moved some of the furniture out, starting with the trendier pieces. Isabel would have been mortified at Cog's sparse furnishings, but Jonathan supposed that was the difference between the two personalities. Cog was sitting on the dormer windowsill. She had shed her coat and was wearing a wool skirt and a white pleated blouse underneath. It made her look strange, even artificial, to wear such normal clothes. Jonathan thought she looked better in armor. In her hands she held a beautiful, polished wooden instrument, a maple-top lute with a blood-red mahogany body. The rosewood fingerboard was inlaid with sparrows and wheat stalks, delicately carved from mother-of-pearl, and the gut frets bore golden bars across the top. Flat, wooden vines had been sculpted to crisscross the sound hole, and they snaked around the body, culminating in carved wildflowers adorning the top of the headstock. The silver strings flashed under her fingertips as she pressed the form of a chord.
What kind of guitar is that?" asked Jonathan.
Cog smirked.
"It's not a guitar. It's like a guitar, but civilized."
"Actually, I like guitars. The guitar is good," said Jonathan.
Cog bowed her head ever so slightly.
"I pray that you'll forgive my offense, then."
It's fine. I don't really know what it is."
"It's a lute. We used to play them in the Great Hall,"
she said, adjusting the balance of the round instrument body in her lap. Her fingers moved across the fret straps behind the thick neck, and she tightened a loose fret. Jonathan looked over the instrument. It was obviously brand new, and it looked as though its strings may have only been plucked once or twice. "Do you still remember how to play? I mean, hasn't it been a while?"
"For the world, maybe, but not for me. Why do you ask?"
That made sense to Jonathan. Even though she was hundreds of years old,
She was sleeping for so much of that time before she was awoken by Jonathan and Milton. No reason, I mean, Jonathan scratched his head. I heard that you were playing when I was out in the, hall. Cog's genteel expression flattened.
I was tuning it. It's brand new.
Oh, Jonathan laughed nervously. Okay, so, you just bought it then?
Yes. The Seeker's paymaster sent me a check for my services in the retrieving of the idol.
Was it a lot? The loot, I mean. Cog pondered the question. Jonathan thought that she might not be good with modern prices yet, and did not plan to press the issue if she didn't know.
Well, it cost about as much as, Well, I guess it cost about as much as one of your automobiles, if you were to buy them new.
Are you sure? Those things get expensive. Cog told Jonathan the price. Apparently, a good loot was expensive, too. Jonathan had a seat. Cog also disclosed that she had left Milton a sizable amount for rent, since she had no need of food. Jonathan helped her to understand that normal people did not pay a full year of working wages to their landlord alone. Working together, they formulated a sensible number, though Jonathan assured her that the rent was unnecessary. She was their charge, and she never made a mess, never ate, and scarcely made noise. She didn't even need to take baths. It sounds like the Seekers paid you a lot, said Jonathan.
I thought that I should give you all of it, but you told me that was unnecessary last time,
she replied. Oh, of course. Your money is your own, Cog. Your life is your own. She smiled a distant smile. Her smooth white skin caught the sun and embraced it with warm luminance. Two tiny stars, reflections of the sun, alighted upon her eyes as she turned to face the window.
I'm not ready to be released from your service yet, unless you would no longer have me.
Jonathan laughed. Please feel free to stay as long as you want. You're a joy to have around.
Thank you,
said Cog. Cog?
Yes.
If you're gonna work for the Seekers so much, why not just join us? Asked Jonathan.
Well, because no organization of that size can be trusted,
she said.
I can trust you. I can go wherever you go, and if you are corrupt, you must face those around you. The Seekers cannot be trusted to do what is morally right with their power. There is no accountability.
Cog fingered the pegs of the loot.
Why did you join?
You know that I have to learn to control my magic, Cog, said Jonathan. I think that the Seekers can help.
Have they helped you yet, Jonathan?
She asked. She was silently signing the intricate patterns of a song along the neck of the lute. I'm certain that they will soon. My rank is still very low, said Jonathan. Besides, I'm committed now. It's like the army. You can't leave unless you're willing to face the consequences. Cog made eye contact with Jonathan, and her glass eyes seemed to glow with reflected light.
Jonathan, you may leave any time that you wish, and I promise that no harm will come to you. I have yet to meet a Seeker that frightens me.
Jonathan sat down next to her on the sill, and she moved to give him space. He wanted to place a hand upon her shoulder or knee to reinforce his appreciation, but he was still unsure of what was traditional in her culture, even after 2 years. Jonathan wished she hadn't moved. It would have been a nice distance being that close. He imagined taking her hand and kissing it, like in the books that he had read. Unsure of where they should go, his hands folded themselves timidly in his lap, and he attempted to smile with the confidence that he did not have. Look, I couldn't disappoint Isabel like that, but I'm indebted to you all the same, said Jonathan, thinking that phrase sounded very proper. He liked the idea that maybe Cog's speech patterns were rubbing off on him.
You owe me nothing,
said Cog. In the awkward pause that followed, she straightened up and asked,
So, has Agent Carragher already left town, then?
Yeah. Isabel should be arriving in Cerceval tomorrow night.
Are you worried about her?
Isabel? Said Jonathan. I'm much more worried about anybody who tries to bother her.
That's exactly what I like about her,
said Cog.
I hope we see more of her. She hasn't been coming round lately.
Jonathan gestured to the lute. I'll tell her to come by. I'm sure she'll want to hear you play that thing. Cog's expression showed her displeasure at the word thing. The lute. I'm sure that she's never heard an instrument that costs as much as a car. Cog stared, albeit politely, and waited for a better turn of phrase. I am sure that she would like to hear you play. She'll be excited that you have a hobby. I don't think Isabel knows that much about you.
I'm sorry. I didn't know she wanted to know anything about me. I try not to talk too much about myself,
said Cog. I've noticed.
Then I'll try to be more social. Would you like to hear some music?
Jonathan leaned back against the wall and watched as Cog set her lute in position on the crook of her crossed leg. Her fingers flew across the strings, and the fluttering concordance of notes that followed spoke of spring. Music flowed from the instrument, like water from melting ice, and each new arpeggio brought warmth to the air. Locks of her short, brilliant red hair fell in front of her eyes as she minded the fretboard, her shoulders swaying in time. Cog reached the end of a complex series and stopped, inhaling sharply. Her precise fingers froze, holding exact position over the strings. Then, like someone stepping down into a pool of water, she slowly began to play again, this time of winter, calling to the snow with her music. Cog took a deep breath, and then she began to sing sweetly. Jonathan had no idea why it touched him so deeply, so unfamiliar, and yet so nostalgic. The music carried Jonathan past the windows, past the streets, and into a frosted clearing. Each strike of the strings was the fragile snap of an ice-crusted twig. Each rest was a footstep in snow. The chorus was elegiac yet subtle, like someone begging for the return of a long-dead lover. Cog's voice was clearer than water, yet rich, warm, and comforting, each word digging deeper into Jonathan's heart. Jonathan watched her trembling vermilion lips as they formed the lonely words of a dirge. The language was Kaldavi, but somehow, on an instinctual level, he understood everything. He imagined flags and mist, the body of a departed soul laid on snow. Something uncoiled inside of Jonathan, a terrible force that understood the dirge even better than the initiate. Jonathan's hand shot out and caught Cog's pick hand, stopping the song instantly. His heart ached horribly, and his vision seemed to pitch before him as he realized he was not alone in the clearing of his mind. Stop, he said. She looked hurt.
I'm sorry. I've displeased you.
No, no, I'm sorry. I'll leave, said Jonathan. I'll get out of your way, and I'll let you play. And he stood to leave, wiping the sweat off his blanched skin. He didn't want to admit his weakness. He didn't want her to know how close he had come to losing control.
I hoped you'd come to listen more often.
I can. I'm just not sure about that song. What stirs in Jonathan's heart? And what of Cog's mysterious heritage? What business does Isabel's secretive contact have in Cercival? Is it a trap? Find out next Monday night on The Gearheart.
This podcast is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, visit creativecommons.org.
This podcast has been brought to you by Little Angels Private Investigations, a bunch of babies with too many bullets and not enough to lose. Great for bar mitzvahs and investigations of infidelities. Little Angels Private Investigations, when you have to get bad news, best to hear it from the mouths of babes. And by Gina Mays, old-fashioned arsenic. Perfect for cleaning up jewelry or cleaning out grandma. When you want that inheritance and a way to clean it, think Gina Mays.